I'm diving on a reef in complete darkness, except for what my flashlight is shining on. And I'm just hypnotized by all these pink orbs slowly floating to the surface. And from my right side, you see this big fish dart through and grabbing up all of the spawn because it's becoming fish food and a big part of why corals reproduce en masse in that way and broadcast spawn is the strategy is sort of a shotgun approach where, you know, we'll just throw it out there and hope some of them make it. And so a lot of them fall prey to different fish. And I think something that I do a lot, I'm just looking at this coral, I'm watching it spawn, I'm seeing the bundles get released by the polyps. And there's all this other stuff going around me. And it can be so easy to get entranced by this meter by meter area and seeing all the interactions, all the symbioses, all the small animals like nudibranchs and crabs and corals. Meanwhile, you look up in the water column and you're getting circled by fish and sharks and turtles. And to your left, you see a giant clam spawning as well. It just can be overwhelming, the kind of underwater chorus of just life and the beauty of life replenishing and reproducing. And it makes me feel very grateful and small in a really good way.
Hey, I'm Danny Washington, and welcome to 21st Century Mermaids. As a dedicated ocean advocate, STEM educator, and avid underwater adventurer, I consider myself a modern-day mermaid. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, determination, and a bit of style. Guests we feature are actively welcome the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development and addressing the UN's 2019 theme for World Oceans Day, which is Gender and the Ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid. Intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our big blue planet. Dr. Erica Woolsey is a marine biologist, National Geographic explorer, CEO and co-founder of The Hydrus, a virtual reality filmmaker, and a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab.
I have a bracelet that's coral. Well, it's not real coral. It's just a coral pattern, but it feels a little bit mermaidy, like mermaidy jewelry. Yeah.
Your hair looks mermaidy too today.
So does yours. So luxuriant.
Oh, let's get it bigger. Okay. Awesome. Awesome. So here we are. Let's get this party started. Welcome, Ooh. Dr. Erica Woolsey.
Thank you, Danny. I'm so happy that we're doing this.
I am ecstatic that we're doing this right now. This feels like a dream that's truly coming to fruition, to be able to collaborate with you and to hear your story in depth and to make space in our busy lives during this tumultuous time to talk about the place that we love the most. That is so important to me right now, and this is what's filling my spirit. So thank you for making that available.
Thank you. And since I met you, gosh, like a year ago, I've just loved having our conversations about women and the ocean and how unique that relationship is and how we need so many more ocean women and 21st century mermaids to keep the dream and the love alive.
Absolutely. We are living in such special times. I think it's a privilege to be here to see the world transform in the way that it is. It's painful and hard at times, but we're still here and we're still swimming.
100%. All you can do is keep swimming. Sometimes we can tread water, and if we need to kind of like float or sink, that's okay. We'll keep an eye on each other, make sure neither of us are drowning.
Absolutely. Yeah, no doubt about that. So let's jump into it. So I really am curious about your childhood, the way that you grew up, because we've shared short stories with each other about, you know, growing up on two different coasts. You grew up on the West Coast. I grew up on the East Coast. Cold water versus warm water, all those fun things. But what do you specifically remember as a kid growing up on the Pacific side of the United States? And when did your passion for the ocean begin?
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so I grew up looking at the bay, I grew up looking at the Pacific Ocean, and I remember going to the beach with my family. I remember going tide pooling with school groups. I remember going to the Monterey Bay Aquarium and the California Academy of Sciences and being just enamored with the sparkle of the sea and all of the amazing life that's in it. And I think, like a lot of young women, I especially love things like dolphins and sea lions and marine mammals and all the charismatic megafauna. And I even worked at the Marine Mammal Center over in Sausalito for a while, helping rescue and treat and release injured and stranded seals and sea lions. And as I sort of followed my curiosities, I was always really interested in biology. And I thought maybe I would be a veterinarian or even like a pediatrician. And I wanted to study medicine and take care of animals and take care of people. And when I was in my undergrad, I was studying biology and got a little distracted by stuff in the ocean because my college had a marine lab on the coast of North Carolina, actually. So I got to, you know, go over to your side. And I learned how to dive in Monterey Bay among the kelp forests. And I did it with my brother and my dad. And I just started wanting to be underwater all the time. You know, it's that feeling of weightlessness and calm. And it feels meditative because diving is really just controlled floating. And you can move yourself up and down based on your breath. And it's just incredible. And so how it worked with me is studying at the Duke Marine Lab on the coast of North Carolina and then spending some time in Bermuda, where I discovered coral reef ecology. I started understanding coral reefs and it started with, oh my gosh, look at all these glittering jewels underwater. What a beautiful place. Then that turned into, huh, this is also really fascinating from, you know, a physiological perspective, the amazing symbiotic relationships you see on a coral reef and what it means for an entire ecosystem to have a reef habitat. And then beyond that, I started learning, huh, not only is this ecologically valuable and fascinating, but it's also super important. And we talk about, you know, the connections between human and the ocean, and that is a impossible to disentangle connection. We are not separate. We rely on the ocean, and hundreds of millions of people rely on coral reefs around the world. And it became a little bit more urgent to study and explore coral reefs. And I continued to follow my curiosities all the way to the biggest reef on Earth, the Great Barrier Reef. So I lived and worked in Australia for about 7 years. I earned my PhD at James Cook University in tropical North Queensland, studying the effects of warming oceans on coral reef ecosystems. And I just feel so fortunate to have spent so much time underwater, so much time on research station islands and on research vessels and collaborating with some amazing people and some amazing minds who are super curious about what's going on in these ecosystems and what the future holds for coral reefs, especially as they relate to people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, I have to acknowledge you right now to say, first of all, you're super brave for being able to learn how to dive in Monterey Bay. Okay, the water's cold. I could barely stand LA's water. It's Southern California off of Catalina Island. I mean, I'm wearing a 7 mil wetsuit and still shivering underwater. So big ups to you.
I like to say that learning to dive in Monterey Bay is like learning how to parallel park on the hills of San Francisco. If you can do it there, you can do it anywhere.
That is a great analogy. Yes, I can. Yes, that's definitely true. And you mentioned your dad and your brother were with you when you were learning how to dive, when you were getting your open water dive certification and beyond. Are you a master diver today?
I'm a dive master, actually. So I worked in dive shops and I've led dives and expeditions. And I just love taking people into the water. And I love giving that gift of introducing people to diving and even to snorkeling. I'm also a kayak guide. So I just feel so grateful to have had that family setting where I could learn how to dive as a teenager. And even though I did it with my dad and my brother, I should also mention that my little sister dives now too. And my mom's not a diver, but she is an incredible support when it comes to marine science. In fact, I'm working with her on some projects lately. And I know you and I, Danny, have talked about how important our mothers have been in our paths to be ocean women.
Yes, we have so many parallels in our lives that I love that we can share. We'll definitely get more into that in a moment. But I am curious to know, you know, between your parents, your dad being underwater with you and going with you through your dive course, and your mom not so much, but being clearly a support for you, what was their initial reaction when you first expressed to them that this is the career path you wanted to follow, that you were passionate about the ocean, and that you just wanted to be in this space?
I have had nothing but support from my parents. And again, just the fact that I was able to follow my curiosities, and they emotionally and financially and in all the ways you can support somebody, they helped me get there. I think I remember diving with my dad and brother on a coral reef years before I started my graduate studies. And I just said, I want to get a PhD in coral reefs. And I didn't really know what that meant, but I was just so enamored and fascinated. And of course, their response was like, cool, do it.
So rad. So rad. I wish everyone had parents just like that. In contrast, you know, over the years in talking with different women in marine science and men as well, you know, a lot of them shared a similar experience that I had. I mean, my parents, my biological parents were both very supportive of me. But beyond my parents, most people who I encountered in my childhood and teenage years, and I expressed to them my love for the ocean and that I wanted to pursue a career in marine biology, they would look at me and say, you're never going to make any money. Mm. Or, you know, we don't do that. We being people of color, Black people. And it was so disheartening, but at the same time, it was fuel for me. It kept me moving. And I was like, I'm going to do this. I don't care what you say. I'm going to do it. Maybe it's the Capricorn in me, but I just, it took those comments to really push me forward. But like you, I had fantastic parents who fed me everything that they could to fuel that passion, even though they had no clue as to why I wanted to do it. Like, because they didn't necessarily see themselves in that place, but they knew they wanted to support me as their child. And that is just such a huge blessing.
I have chills right now because I'm just thinking about how, you know, one of the purposes of this podcast and having these discussions is so that there is visibility for people to create their own careers. And there isn't just one idea of what a marine biologist is. You can take that kind of knowledge and apply it to so many different types of work. Right now, I run a nonprofit. I teach at universities. I do some consulting work, and I get to do cool stuff like this with you. And it doesn't always look like sitting in a lab or, you know, being an academic. You can take it into so many different directions. And we always want more marine scientists, but I also really want people that are not marine scientists that care about the ocean. So folks that are policymakers or artists or lawyers or doctors or citizens and voters to have ocean connection and a literacy for ocean science and to become advocates and appreciators of how important our blue planet is.
Mm, absolutely.
So that's a big part of why I love that we're having these discussions, Danny, is that a big part of this podcast is to create visibility that you can be a mermaid, you can be a marine scientist, you can be an ocean advocate in any way that you want, and you can design your own career. It will come from, you know, an informed populace and knowledgeable constituents that vote for policies and work in their communities and have that ocean literacy and connection. And it's so important to have a combination of scientific communities as well as every other community.
The ocean belongs to all of us. So we have to be vested in it no matter where we live, even if you're in the middle of the United States, in the plains of the Midwest. We need you. We need you in this ocean community because it's our life source.
If you like breathing and eating, you should like the ocean. And I really like what you say, that the ocean belongs to all of us because it makes us feel that ownership and that responsibility. And I would also say that we belong to the ocean. It supports all life on Earth. And it's the reason that we're surviving on this planet.
Erica, the work you do at the Hydrus and at Stanford is collaborative and multidisciplinary. How did you learn to combine so many elements like biology, immersive storytelling, and emerging technology?
I had really wonderful teachers. So in high school, I had an amazing biology teacher that I just loved talking with. I had a love for the ocean with some of my friends. And I feel like it was really fostered because everyone feels a connection to water and the ocean. And I was just so fortunate to never be made to feel like what I was doing didn't make sense. And I'd also like to add that I was also an artist growing up and an athlete. I was a three-sport varsity team captain, MVP kind of thing. So nobody's just one thing. And in my career now, I realize how important that art training was and how important that sports training was, because it teaches me about leadership and of storytelling and teamwork, you know, learning how to fail together and persevere.
Discipline.
Discipline, 100%. Were you an athlete?
I was. I was a tennis player and a flag football player.
Nice.
What sports did you play?
I played basketball, softball, and volleyball. I was also a competitive swimmer for a number of years. And so I love being in the water. It feels like such a natural state for me. And when I was studying biology in my undergrad, my minor was art history. At the time, it didn't really make sense to anybody because a lot of bio majors minored in chemistry or maybe a language. And when people asked me why, like, what does art history have to do with biology? I couldn't really answer them because I didn't know yet. But at the time, it just felt like the right thing, and it helped me balance my life, and it was something I was really interested and fascinated in. And now, I mean, the work that I'm doing, I now teach at a design school, and I love combining human-centered design and problem-solving in a creative way with ocean issues. And I think there's something really magical there at the intersection of people, of science, and of technology. And I think the underpinning is this empathy and connection that you and I talk about.
Yes, and technology is a major component. But within technology, like you said before, art is at the heart and soul of that. You have to have a creative mind in order to develop technology, because you have to think outside of the box, think of things that don't exist. And if you're not utilizing that part of your brain, then you're not going to come up with the answer, because it's not linear, it's expansive, and you have to explore all of your options. When we're being expansive in this field, I think our job and one of our inherent roles where we are right now as women in marine science is to dismantle that perception of what a marine scientist looks like, that it's no longer just a white male in a lab coat or a white male on a boat out looking at dolphins. Like, I think that's still the stereotype that many people hold about this career. And designing your own career is so vitally important to show how multidimensional we are as human beings in general. And we have to infuse all of our different talents and gifts into our core passion. And I think you've done that so beautifully. And so I want to talk next about your journey through, you know, Duke. You went to Duke University for your undergrad as you studied biology and art history. I know that Duke has one of the most premier graduate programs in marine science. Did you get a chance to have lots of field experiences and internships and volunteer opportunities while you were at Duke?
Oh, yeah. And I feel like the more you ask around and talk to people, including professors and other students, the more opportunities you find. And so I was lucky to discover the Duke Marine Lab in Beaufort, North Carolina, where I studied invertebrate zoology and physiology of marine organisms. And I it was like, it felt like science camp, because it was such a adorable little campus. And one of our classes, we all had our own aquarium that we would keep animals alive during the semester and study them. And from there, I was an undergrad, but I was able to take some classes with master students and sort of get a little bit more perspective about what might come next in this career path. And I also took advantage of a couple of broad programs, including in Bermuda, where I worked at or studied at the bio station there, and had some incredible professors, and all of our labs were underwater. So to take the course, you had to be a diver. And, you know, every day we would be in the water learning how to conduct surveys, learning about physiology. And that hands-on, literally immersive experience was life-changing. And just having that level of instruction and expertise was so valuable, because while we talk about connection and storytelling, it's so important to have that underpinning of, you know, credibility and science and fact to make sure that everything we do is evidence-based and compassionate but informed.
I love that. Compassionate and informed. Yes. Based in truth and based in fact. That is so necessary, especially right now.
100%. That could be a whole other discussion.
So while you were at the Duke Marine Lab and your experiences in Bermuda, what was a moment where you had this aha light bulb feeling that you had maybe an ocean encounter or something happened that moved you even further into your field?
My area of expertise and how I spent a lot of years was surrounding coral reproduction. And the way that corals reproduce is fascinating. They're miraculous organisms. They can basically turn seawater into rock to build the reef. And by building the reef, it means that they're reproducing asexually and cloning themselves and growing. And for genetic recombination, which we know is important, they also sexually reproduce. Because corals, adult corals, are cemented to the seafloor, when it comes time to find a mate, they can't just like walk over to another colony and spawn or copulate. And they're not like trees, because trees have pollinators and plants have pollinators. And there are no pollinators in the ocean to exchange that genetic information, meaning egg and sperm. And so what corals have evolved to do, the great majority of corals on the Great Barrier Reef, for instance, broadcast spawn. So they, based on ocean temperatures, based on lunar cycles, based on light levels, they synchronize their spawning. So for instance, a colony of corals that's like a meter by meter can release 1 million eggs.
1 million eggs.
1 million eggs, yes. And so for the hermaphroditic spawners, so the species that are both male and female, they release these little pink or orange bundles filled with egg and sperm that slowly float up at nighttime during or shortly after the full moon, and then break apart at the surface by the agitation of the water, and then cross-fertilize with other egg and sperm from the same species that were physically separate from them. And that fertilized egg will develop into a larva over a few days, during which it can be carried great distances to then go back down to the seafloor and metamorphose into a new young coral. And so there's this incredible life cycle, and I'm just so fascinated by coral sex, essentially. And on the Great Barrier Reef, where I did a lot of my research on coral spawning, it happened after the November full moon. And so I would have to tell my family that for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years straight, I wasn't able to come home for Thanksgiving because the corals were spawning. I planned my life around the sex lives of corals. And this is known as the most synchronized sex event in the whole animal kingdom. And so my aha moment was first witnessing coral spawning, annual coral spawning that happens once a year after the November full moon, when the sun goes down, the whole reef gets sexy and releases these beautiful pink orbs that float to the surface. It's just like, it reminds me a lot of those sort of lantern festivals. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And it is the way that reefs replenish themselves and grow and persevere and reproduce and recover from disturbances like bleaching events or cyclones or habitat destruction. So I'm just fascinated on so many levels, socially, ecologically, and scientifically, of this incredible natural phenomenon that I've been able to witness.
Wow. You know, I've read a lot about corals and of course coral spawning, and I've always wanted to experience it underwater. I have yet to do that. But I want to hear from you, your perspective. Take us diving with you. What was it like when you were there on the Great Barrier Reef in November doing one of the coral spawns? What did it feel like? Take us on the journey from the moment you jumped off of the dive boat into the water.
So first of all, it's kind of hard to get the timing exactly right, because after the November full moon, it might be 2 days, it might be 4 days, it might be 6 days. And over those nights, certain species might spawn at the same time, but other species might spawn on a different night. So it's kind of a little bit of a mixed bag. When you go diving, you're not sure if you're going to see spawning. And so getting ready to dive to see the spawning is incredible. partially because it's at night. And there's something really exhilarating about night diving, where all you can see is what your flashlight is shining on, and different animals are out at night. And during the spawning, because there's all this reproductive material in the water, it turns into fish food in a lot of ways. And the corals aren't the only ones spawning. You have giant clams over here and sea cucumbers and fish. Like, the whole reef is just so sexy at that time. And it's so eerie and different than any other time of the year. And to be surrounded by coral spawning feels like you're in a snow globe, like a pink snow globe. Just to feel all of that activity and to see the moonlight coming down and have the sparkle of the coral bundles against your underwater flashlight is as magical as it gets. I love combining science and magic, by the way. That to me is what gives me life.
I love that. I love that. And that is exactly the essence of a mermaid as well. It's like, we're combining magic with science.
Science, love, and magic are my three favorite things. And Danny, I want to ask you, we talked about this briefly the other day, but what do you think the life cycle of a mermaid is, since their lower half is a fish?
That is a great question, Erica. I think the debate is the way that their fins are oriented. We know that mermaids, they move their fins up and down, similar to cetaceans, rather than side to side compared to bony fish. So I would assume that mermaids reproduce internally, similar to marine mammals. That would be my guess.
I never thought about that way. So their bottom half isn't a fish. Their bottom half is a marine mammal.
That's what I would believe. Yes.
That's a lot more, that's more consistent, that you would have, you know, two halves of mammals rather than, you know, one half fish, one half human. I feel like biologically that makes more sense.
Right. And then I think also genetic history, we're more related to cetaceans than we are to fish. So that's how I would justify it.
I love it. I feel like we should write a textbook on the physiology of mermaids.
I'm down. Let's do it. So after experiencing coral spawning and doing your graduate research in Australia for 7 years, what would be the main idea that you left Australia with? What was your mission from that point on?
So around the time I was wrapping up my PhD in Australia, we were seeing a lot of mass coral bleaching, which is caused by higher than normal temperatures, which stress out the coral animal to expel their algal symbionts. So it's a specialized type of algae that lives inside the coral that photosynthesizes and provides the coral enough energy to build the reef and survive and reproduce. So zooxanthellae refers to the symbiotic algae that actually lives in the coral tissue. And so it can take sunlight, the energy from the sun, and turn it into food for the coral to survive. And most corals get about, at least shallow water corals, get about 70% of the energy they need to survive from their zooxanthellae. And without them, not only does the coral lose color, because coral animals, the polyps, are soft-bodied and clear. So without their zooxanthellae, you can see through the clear animal to their white calcium carbonate or limestone skeleton. And that's why it's called bleaching. And a bleached reef isn't a dead reef. It's more like a starving reef. However, these bleaching events have been leading to high rates of mortality. And because there are so many animals, in addition to coral, that live on a coral reef and rely on that habitat that they build, it leads to ecosystem collapse. So I was always interested in the effects of warming oceans on coral reefs. And when I started seeing bleached and dead reefs and thinking about, how is this going to grow back? Because dead corals don't spawn. We might rely on a healthy coral somewhere else that maybe the larvae will be carried by the ocean currents to the degraded reef. And we are seeing that. We can see regeneration. However, the rate at which bleaching events are happening are much quicker than the time needed to replenish and regrow and recover. And so as I progressed in my science career, I was getting more and more specialized, and I was publishing and going to conferences and working with amazing people. However, at that juncture, I really believed that my audience needed to be getting bigger, because more people need to know about what's happening underwater, because the ocean is overexploited, underprotected, and out of mind. And we as scientists need to do a much better job to translate scientific discovery in our ocean into public understanding and action. That was a critical juncture when I moved back to California and I started a nonprofit with my amazing co-founders, focused entirely on how can we connect more people to beautiful and threatened ocean ecosystems like coral reefs.
And what year did you leave Australia and make your way back to the US?
2014 is when I graduated with my PhD. And so I've been home like 6 years and it's been an incredible time. And I've discovered design thinking at Stanford, working with them in the Center for Ocean Solutions and the D School, thinking about ways to creatively approach these problems from a human-centered perspective, because we really need science. But without that human element, that translation is near impossible. And you and I have talked about this, and something I love about what you do is you're so engaging, and rather than trying to convince people of things with data, you connect with them on an emotional human level. And that's what I want to do. Like, and so I'm so lucky to be doing this with you, because it's all about storytelling and connection with the basis of evidence and of science and of these really important systems we have to gain systematic knowledge of our natural world.
Yes. Connecting to the heart is the priority now. We have to start with the emotion in order to crack open their minds and those who haven't really understood why the ocean is so important to humanity, and then infiltrate it with lots of good facts and information and data so that they understand the context of where we are in this moment in time. And so when you completed your PhD in 2014, you made your way back to the US, you started moving forward with this idea, this revelation that you had about making this human connection with marine science so people could understand the importance specifically of coral health around the world and how we are inextricably connected to corals and we depend on them to maintain healthy ocean ecosystems. How did you manifest that revelation? What did it become?
Well, we had several methods of trying to approach that question in terms of how can we connect more people to the ocean and create what we like to call open access oceans, because I'm really interested in radical access and radical empathy and calling people in to the conversation. And one of the tools we use, which has really taken off, is virtual reality. So the electronic immersion of a person on a reef through 360-degree film, through a virtual reality environment, is tremendous. And since I started using that as a tool, the reactions I've had from people and the stories they want to tell me about their ocean experience and the questions they have is like nothing I've ever seen before. And so intuitively, I can see that there's something there and there's a real spark, and this is a real amazing tool to generate empathy. And I want to take that a step further as a scientist. So I'm working with some amazing partners at the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford, with HTC, with the National Science Foundation, to research scientifically how immersive virtual reality affects things like empathy and ocean science literacy and feelings of self-efficacy, like you can accomplish things. And we're working with different school groups throughout the Bay Area, and we're really interested in gender, race, and income as potential factors, because maybe virtual reality can also increase ocean literacy and empathy, but it also might help bridge some other gaps. And so I'm really excited to share whatever we find. But of course, right now, all those projects are on hold.
Right. But you've done some incredible work so far. And when you founded the Hydrus, obviously, it's a collaborative project and has been since day one. I want to hear more about your relationship with your mom and how she has helped support you in creating this mission.
So yes, it is a collaborative effort. And the Hydrus is a community of people that care about the ocean. And we have designers on our team, we have educators, we have technologists, we have incredible storytellers and photographers and filmmakers. And yes, we have my mom. And what was so fun is, you know, I traveled the world studying marine biology and thinking that she and I didn't have a lot in common professionally. But then I come home and I realize that she has such this amazing expertise and past in using technology for education. So she actually founded the Apple Multimedia Lab in the 80s and is known as the mother of multimedia. So
what?
And she's trained as a cognitive psychologist. She has her PhD in cognitive psychology. So she's really interested about the use of physical space and learning space and virtual space. And so I feel so freaking lucky to have my mom to advise me on how things have been done in the past, because using technology for education and thinking about learning science and how people learn and connect, she has that knowledge. So I love talking to her about these things, and I feel so fortunate that we can work together. And, you know, like you work with your mother, I think there's really something there about women in science having that mentorship. And I know not everybody has had mothers like ours. And so I think just creating that community where we can be each other's mentors and see things that not everybody sees, I think is so valuable in that visibility and that encouragement.
I too am grateful that we can share that experience of working with our moms, because I know for most people, when I share that part of my life, they're like, you work with your mom? Like, most would not even be able to fathom working professionally with their mothers. I mean, we love our mothers, of course, but it's a whole different layer and a different dynamic. And it, of course, it's been a journey understanding each other and making sure that we find levels of mutual respect in that regard so that we can get the job done with love, with, again, with respect and with our own individual passions and talents. And my mom is a business owner herself and an entrepreneur, and her business acumen has been the main catalyst to help me maintain the organization we founded, the Big Blue and You, back in 2008, because we saw the need for children in our community in South Florida that were not connecting to the ocean that was right in their backyard, miles away, yet they hadn't experienced it. So we, between our love and passion for children and making sure the next generation is taken care of, and our passion for the ocean, the environment, and wildlife and animals, we knew that this would be a perfect combination and just an opening for us to build more community and to show the connection of all people in South Florida. And yeah, it's been a labor of love, that's for sure. but we've grown in so many ways and grown closer. And I really can't even begin to express how grateful I am for that, because I just have a phenomenal mom. And I know you do too.
You and our mom should like go out for brunch or something. I feel like that would be a really fun time.
We definitely have to, or some kind of mother-daughter retreat, something fun.
I would love that so much.
Yes.
But Dani, I love and admire you so much. And I'm just so impressed with everything you do in the world. And I feel so lucky to connect with you on this level and have these conversations. And I'm so excited to continue these conversations with more women around the world that have their own unique perspectives and are similar to us in some ways and different to us. There are just so many amazing stories out there of other mermaids doing their thing.
Doing their thing. It's this beautiful, divine, feminine force that we are creating, a wave of change. That's where we are. And we're seeing it in all different levels of our society, where women are now taking the lead, whether voluntarily or we're having to push our way through. But now is the time. I think we've had this imbalance between feminine and masculine energies for too long. And that's the reason why we're in so many of the predicaments that we are now. But if we make more room and open up the door for women to show their leadership and to express our collaborative nature, I think the sky's the limit and the possibilities are infinite.
The future is ours, and I'm so excited to be building it with you.
I'm excited too, and I love you so much, Erica.
Love you too. So definitely check out all these learning resources we have on our website at thehydro.us. Thehydrus.com was taken, so it's thehydro.us. We have some really great resources in how you can find our 360 film, where we've been doing some virtual dives all around the world and different learning opportunities. And just check us out, join our community. And I also want to say that, inspired by the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development, which is 2021 to 2030, the Hydrus is launching what we're calling the Decade of Ocean Empathy. And so bringing in that human emotion and connection into the discussions around marine science. And Dani, next time I see you, I'm going to give you one of these blue heart pins to represent and capture your ocean story and your love for the ocean.
That is beautiful. And so make sure to check them out online, thehydro.us. But it's beautiful. Like it says the hydrist if you just take out the dot. It's great. Awesome. All right, Erica Woolsey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Danny. Great talking with you.
21st Century Mermaids is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Curious Audio is our producer. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. This podcast is supported by the Baum Foundation. Our production assistants are Carrie Wenzel and Apurva Iyengar. Marketing and communication strategist is Angela Bermudo. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.